The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective, Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed, and Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.
Israel prepares for a direct attack by Iran while reckoning with the prospect of losing the war with Hamas.
So this is leading to great frustration in the Israeli military, which has been telling Netanyahu for months that he needs to come up with a plan for who rules Gaza that isn't Hamas, and that decision has simply never been taken.
Plus, China orders its telecom carriers to stop using American chips, and Oakland has decided on a new name for its international airport, and San Francisco isn't happy. It's Friday, April 12th. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. We begin in Israel, where we're reporting that the country is preparing for a direct attack from Iran on its territory within the next 48 hours. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to respond directly against any attack and has promised that his government was prepared to meet all of the security needs of the state of Israel, both defensively and offensively. However, the journals Marcus Walker and Shandy Race are reporting today that after 6 months of fighting Hamas, Israel's military may still be winning isolated battles, but increasingly risks losing its broader Gaza war. And Marcus Walker is here to explain what is informing that assessment. Marcus, winning battles but potentially losing the war. How so? What is not working for the Israeli military?
In the end, it's the politics. All warfare is an instrument for achieving a political goal, a politically defined war aim. Israel's core war aim was to destroy Hamas as a military force that can threaten Israel and as a political entity that can dominate and control Gaza. Now, if Hamas were simply a list of people that can be killed, that would be one thing, but it isn't. It's more of a political brand, as some analysts put it, that can also regenerate itself, which means that in order to get rid of it, Israel needed to come up with a political plan for who governs Gaza after it swept Hamas's regime away. Israel has never found the answer to that question, which is why, as Israeli troops withdraw from the Gaza Strip, which they do not want to occupy themselves, they have been leaving a political vacuum, and Hamas has been re-infiltrating areas the Israelis have withdrawn from and is simply coming back and reasserting its control.
It sounds from what you're saying that some of this boils down to the challenge of defeating an ideology through fighting. I noted the U.S. Defense Secretary made some headlines in December with a speech saying that victory in urban warfare is possible, but only when civilians are protected. And if you drive civilians, as he said, quote, into the arms of the enemy, you replace a tactical victory with a strategic defeat, end quote. It sounds like somewhat of a relevant warning given what's going on now.
That is one element of it, for sure. There is definitely no Israeli strategy to win hearts and minds here. On the contrary, one of their approaches to show their adversaries that they will pay a heavy price for attacking Israel, and that includes the Palestinians in general. But of course, this also helps Hamas to recruit new people too. And that is despite the fact that many Gazans are also furious with Hamas for triggering this war. But there's another way of thinking about this. What Israel is trying to do is regime change in the Gaza Strip. But regime change means you have to have an idea of what regime you want to put in place of Hamas. Just as the US tried to build an Afghan republic to replace the Taliban or an Iraqi democracy to replace Saddam Hussein. Now, neither of those went very well in the long run, but at least the US had some sort of a plan. The Israelis simply have no plan for what regime they want to put in place.
And Marcus, your reporting now suggests that divisions are opening up within Israeli leadership over the progress of this war.
The concern has been apparent and even public since at least January, when the Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant and in private also other military figures have made clear that they think there's a serious problem here and that their military efforts might end up bearing no fruit or bringing no lasting strategic gain unless the government takes decision. It's a widely held view in Israel that Netanyahu is avoiding difficult political decisions on who should govern Gaza because the obvious answer is the Palestinian Authority that governs the West Bank, but he doesn't want to have anything to do with it, and nor do the far-right members of his coalition. In other words, it's possible that the only decision that might work in practice in Gaza would also endanger Netanyahu's coalition.
Is there any prospect of a rethink then of this strategy, or is Netanyahu likely to hold course here?
There have really been two or three approaches discussed. One is that you try to involve some local dignitaries in Gaza or clans or something like that. But that's not realistic. Gazan society isn't really the sort of tribal society. It's a mainly urbanized modern society. Another idea would be to involve an international coalition of peacekeepers from Saudi and elsewhere, but they don't want to do it. So really, the inescapable conclusion of the Israeli military is you have to turn to the Palestinian Authority, but Netanyahu absolutely refuses to deal with them.
And in the meantime, Marcus, it sounds like an offensive in Rafah is still at least being talked about. So at least on the surface, no indication of a change of plans.
Netanyahu insists there will be an offensive to take Rafah. He says it's necessary to complete the job of total victory over Hamas. The problem is that the way the Israelis invaded Gaza from north to south, pushing the population ahead of them like a wave, has ended in this huge pileup of 1.5 million refugees crowded into this small town around the Egyptian border, and Hamas's remaining forces hiding among them. And there is simply no easy solution to that. There's nowhere obvious to put that swollen refugee population, and there's no way to attack and take the town without causing an even bigger bloodbath than the battle for Gaza City. And the Americans have very clearly said no.
That was the Wall Street Journal's Marcus Walker. Marcus, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
Coming up, China cuts American chip makers out of the country's telecom systems, and we'll look at the headache facing home buyers ahead of the busy summer season. Those stories and more after the break.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high volume, high speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
We are exclusively reporting that China has ordered the nation's largest telecom carriers to phase out foreign chips from their network equipment by 2027, a directive likely to hit American chip giants Intel and AMD. The Journal's Asia Business editor Neil Western says that follows an improvement in Chinese chips and tech that have made it possible to reduce domestic reliance on American software and hardware.
I mean, China is a huge market for most of these companies, and chip companies are particularly sensitive to the geopolitical rivalry over tech that's going on right now. I mean, they already face rules that mean they can't export some chips to China that are considered high end. So they're being hit from one side there, and now China is also squeezing them out. Intel has warned about the geopolitical risk quite strongly in its recent annual report, and it even mentioned China's program to produce a domestic semiconductor industry. So whilst not a surprise, it does represent a challenge that could see their business shrink in the country continually into the foreseeable future.
China's Ministry of Industry and Information Technology didn't respond to a request for comment, nor did China's two biggest telecom carriers, or AMD, while Intel declined to comment. The U.S. and Russia are using a confidential channel to discuss the potential exchange of prisoners, including the release of jailed Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich and former Marine Paul Whelan. That is according to Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov in the latest sign that both sides are seriously engaged in negotiations to free the two men, the only Americans categorized by the State Department as wrongfully detained in Russia. Gershkovich has been in Moscow's Lefortovo prison for over a year on an espionage allegation that he, the Wall Street Journal, and the U.S. government vehemently deny, while Whelan is serving a 16-year sentence for espionage that he and his family say is bogus. The U.S. Office of the Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs declined to comment on Ryabkov's remarks. A third of the world's lithium reserves is on the agenda today as Elon Musk and Argentine President Javier Milei meet at Tesla's factory in Austin, Texas. Lithium is a key ingredient in the rechargeable batteries that power Tesla's vehicles. And in December, Milei said that Musk and other U.S. companies were interested in investing in Argentina's lithium sector. After months of endorsing each other on social media platform X, the two men are also hoping to ensure the installation of Musk's Starlink satellite system in Argentina. Any commitment from Musk to invest in Argentina would be a significant victory for Milei, who has yet to receive any major new foreign investments 4 months into his administration. Well, this week, markets have largely reset their expectations for interest rate cuts in the U.S., with the debate now shifting somewhat from when to even if the Federal Reserve will move in June. And that is a particular headache for home buyers ahead of the busy summer buying season, in a year in which pretty much everything about how Americans buy and sell properties has changed. Aside from higher mortgage rates, insurance costs have also soared. And as personal finance reporter Veronica Dagger explains, a legal settlement by the National Association of Realtors last month has further upended the market.
Starting in mid-July, buyers might have to pay for their own agent out of pocket if they want one. And this could be tricky for first-time buyers who don't have that much cash sitting around up front. For context, the current system is that the buyer's agent is paid through the commission charged to a seller. And that often runs from 5 to 6% of the purchase price. If all this goes through and the changes happen, buyers will need to negotiate with this agent potentially about how much they're going to pay them. So some people are moving forward quicker with deals. Other people are just proceeding as is. And so this is a big shift potentially for many buyers.
And you can hear more from Veronica on Monday's episode of the Your Money Briefing podcast, which includes a financial checklist for hopeful home buyers. And finally, the next time you're booking a flight to or from San Francisco, you may want to double check the airport code. That's after the City of Oakland's Board of Port Commissioners voted yesterday to change the name of Oakland International Airport to, let me take a breath here, San Francisco Bay Oakland International Airport. Backers say that won't impact its airport code, OAK, but will instead remind travelers that Oakland is in the Bay Area and could lead to more direct flights. Though San Francisco isn't seeing imitation as a form of flattery here. In a statement after the vote, its city attorney said his office plans to pursue litigation to stop the name change on the grounds that it infringes on the trademark of its own San Francisco International Airport, or SFO. And that is What's News for Friday morning. Today's show was produced by Kate Bolivant and Daniel Bach. Our supervising producer is Sandra Kilhoff, and I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. We will be back tonight with a new show. Otherwise, have a great weekend, and as always, thanks for listening.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.